Bhaktivinod Thakur ki jai. This is his appearance day. And I have the privilege of speaking about him three times in a row. Now, this evening, and then tomorrow morning. Because in China, tomorrow is his appearance day. Somehow they're one day off. I think India is too. One day different than us. The box, the music. Okay. If I ask the question, when you think of Bhaktivinoda Thakur, what do you think of? We'd probably be here for an hour and a half. But for the moment, without raising your hand or speaking, just think Bhaktivinoda Thakur. I'll just say a few bullet points and we'll discuss them more this evening. He is a great acharya in our line of disciplic succession. He wrote 100 books. Try writing a book sometime. He became the father of one member of the disciplic succession, Bhaktisiddhanta. He discovered the birthplace of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, which was wrongly identified at the risk of his life to identify it the way that he did. He established throughout India, throughout Bengal, the Namahatta program, which is now known in ISKCON as the Bhakti Riksha program. It's just a different nomenclature. But it was established by Bhakti Vinod Thakur. He did it in a very creative way. The creative way was singing songs. Because many of the people in Bengal of his time, they were not literate, but they liked to sing. And sing in Bengali, and you got them. So he sang, he composed songs, and then sang songs and taught within the structure. There was a, you know, they had to have terminology in Bengali for the person that oversaw many groups within a particular village. And they would sing and learn the teachings of Lord Chaitanya. And there's other methods that he used also, but it was very, very practical, very creative, very effective. And thousands of Namahatta centers were established in Bengal. That was, you know, that's a lifetime's work for one. Any one of those things is a lifetime's work. Write 100 books. Simultaneously, another achievement was he was recognized by the British government as a high court judge, which was unheard of. And it's an achievement. And one of the things we're going to be discussing this evening is time management. There's a devotee couple I know somewhere. Both the husband and wife are medical doctors. They're in charge of several, like they're in charge of all the Bhakti Vriksha groups of that city. And they have children and they have sadhana and they have deities. You know, how are you going to do all that stuff? You go nuts. But it requires time management. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur was very gifted at time management. You know, ahead of his time, he kept a pocket watch. No, that's not common today, but I'll show a picture, a photo. There he is wearing his, you know, outfit and hanging from his pocket as a pocket watch and dangling from his button on his kurta, or shirt. So, you know, for 7 minutes of this and 9 minutes of that, and he was really, to be effective when you have a lot to do, you have to be good at managing time. And he was effective, and he was good at managing time. So that's an outstanding trait about him. He slept very little, he ate very little, and he wrote a lot. He had 10 children. Some of you have 2 children, 1 child. Imagine having 10 children doing all of that. And one of them being a pure devotee. That he trained Bhaktisiddhanta in the process of printing, because it was new during his time, offset printing, which isn't used anymore, but it was beginning in India, and he learned it, and he taught his son A to Z, you know, writing, proofreading, typesetting, editing, the publication work before it gets, you know, the whole system, which then Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur took from his father and used for his mission. So he fathered a pure devotee and taught him how to further the mission. Here's another contribution. He wasn't just thinking India, he was thinking the world. So one of the many things that he did, besides passing on to Bhaktisiddhanta, the world is our field of preaching, he sent an English language, at his own expense, an 86-page little booklet, The Life and Precepts of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, 2 parts, his life and precepts. The life was a summary of Chaitanya Charitamrita, and the precepts was yet another contribution. This is where I want to spend a little bit of time for this morning's class. He established the essential teachings of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu in a terminology, his own terminology, Dasa Mula Tattva. So you're all from India, so you know what mulis are. It's a white root. Muli. Will you call it something else somewhere else?
Radish.
Radish, right, radish. In their language is muli. Muli. So mula means root. So dasa mula means 10 root. Tattva, dasa mula tattva, the 10 essential teachings of Lord Chaitanya. And he propagated and propagated. In his 100 books, I taught a seminar for 1 month on that topic, Dasamula. And what I recall is, it's something like 36 of his books, 36 of his 100 books, he goes through it. He like over and over. So it's a classic style of teaching. Like, here's a couple of examples. Madhvacharya. When you see somebody as sadhu holding up 2 fingers like that, you know what that means. It's Madhvacharya. Because he taught Dvaitavad. And his teaching over and over and over and over, it said that when he left his body, he was teaching Panchabheda. 5 differences. I'll say what they are, but it was like, it was a catechism. He just said it over and over and over and over and okay, got it. So, there's a difference between the Lord and the living entity. There's a difference between the Lord and material nature. There's a difference between one living entity and another living entity. There's a difference between living entity and prakriti. And there's a difference between one type of prakriti and another type of prakriti. Panchabheda. And over and over and over and over. So it's thematic. Baladev Vidyabhusan, you know, from Bhagavad Gita, introduction to Bhagavad Gita. He taught there's 5 topics in Bhagavad Gita. Right? You're familiar? 5 topics in Bhagavad Gita. The Lord or Ishvara, material nature, prakriti, jiva, the living entity, karma, activity, time. And over and over and over in different ways, he, you know, these are five essential teachings that one needs to know to understand the, you know, so it's just a model, but it's a classic approach. So Bhaktivinoda took that classic approach and said there's 10 essential teachings of Lord Chaitanya. He didn't pull them out of the air. That's not how Bhaktivinoda Thakur did what he did. It goes back to Jamunacharya, and he wrote a similar list of, it was 9. Baladev, following Madhvacharya, wrote 10. And then Bhaktivinoda wrote 10. It's not, they're not identical, the 9 and the 10 and the 10. But it was drawn from them, and he just, in his own realization, expressed them. Almost the same. So I'm not going to go through that. That's a whole topic, what those 10 are. But it was a contribution. And I'll say how it applies to us. How it applies to us is, there was a committee formed that went on for about 4 or 5 years called, it's in 50-cent words, the Hermeneutics and Epistemology Committee. What does that mean? Hermeneutics means, how do you read a text? It's a term that's used in different philosophies and different religions. Like, there's a hermeneutics of how you read the Bible. It's not, what does it mean? It's how do you read it? How do you determine what it means? What's the methodology of determining what it means? So that project took shape. There's another committee that was formed. They just passed it on to the Shastra Advisory Committee. Everything has to have an acronym, right? So it's SAC. The Shastra Advisory Committee, they advised the GBC, and they took it. And now they have this voluminous document that's a hermeneutics document. And one of the pieces, there's many things in it, but one of the pieces is, in order to understand Prabhupada's teachings, you have to look at it through the lens of Lord Chaitanya's teachings. And how do you distill Lord Chaitanya's teachings into a capsule form? There's two places. There's one place in Chaitanya Charitamrita where Prabhupada essentially says, this is the essence of my teachings. Or the essence of Lord Chaitanya's teachings. And then there's Bhaktivinoda Thakur. So Bhaktivinoda Thakur contributed a very standard set of the voluminous Lord Chaitanya's teachings. Because another way of saying, what's the teachings of Srimad Bhagavatam in 10 topics? Because the teachings of Lord Chaitanya are the teachings of Srimad Bhagavatam, or the other way around. The teachings of Srimad Bhagavatam are the teachings of Lord Chaitanya. So how do you understand them? You have to look at them through the lens of these 10 essential teachings. Then he expanded on each one of the 10. And, you know, one day, Krishna willing, I have more time than I have of late with other, anyway, I'd like to once again teach that seminar. And probably, you know, at a simple form and then a more expanded form, because it's the essential teachings is a way to look at Lord Chaitanya's teachings. It's a way to look at Prabhupada's teachings through the lens of Lord Chaitanya's teachings. Those are areas, and there's more, but you know, that there's like 6 or 7 lifetimes worth in one person. And at a time that was quite challenging, I'll comment in this regard too. He was born and matured during the height of British occupancy, and what that meant was British propaganda that was explicit and effective. Everything India is backwards and everything European is forwards, without going into detail. And so the intelligentsia of his time bought into it. Poo-poo on everything that's Vedic, and yay, yay, and everything that's from Europe, European literature, European ideology, European products, European everything, European. They were good at it. The propaganda machine was well lubricated. So in the face of that and the popularity of everything European is wonderful and everything India is garbage, at that time also, Lord Chaitanya's teaching had diminished in its repute in part because of deviated followers. Appa Sampradaya. You know the meaning of Sampradaya, the line of disciplic succession. Appa, deviated or broken. And they were prominent. To whatever degree Lord Chaitanya's teachings were prominent, they were the ones that were making it prominent. And it was an abomination. So one of his 100 books is a book about the 13 Appa Sampradayas. By name, how it happened, what their teachings were, how it deviated from the teaching of Lord Chaitanya. It's very, very, you know, careful to historically present how things got to where they are and why it's wrong. And, you know, when you do like that, you're going to get opposition, right? For sure. He was fearless and very powerful. So, so I want to do two things. In addition to speaking about Dasamula, two more things. I want to read. There was a centennial publication by the Gaudiya Math, which is the organization that Bhaktisiddhanta developed, that honored Bhaktivinoda Thakur on his 100th anniversary of his appearance, so some years ago. And I want to read one article that just gives you a flavor of how he wrote. Now, one of the things that those of you that are householders might appreciate is he always included instructions general, instructions customized for householders, instructions customized for renunciates, because he was a householder and he knew what household life was like and its challenges and what made it successful. And he explained it over and over, you know, each time some teaching came. So in this case, the article I'm going to read is, it's a description of a particular category of, anartha nivritti, eradication of unwanted things. There's 9 stages of bhakti. Preliminary faith, association with sadhus, devotional practice, then the next stage is anartha nivritti. Eradication of unwanted things in the heart. So this particular article that I'm going to read was published by Bhaktisiddhanta in a book, a publication, The Harmonist. Where does it begin? Got all mixed up. And the pages are not numbered. Oh, fooey. Time out, will I find out? Because just by transporting it, got all jumbled up. It is numbered. Oh, it is numbered. Okay. 76. It must be 77. That's 77. Okay, that goes here. Ah, okay. Okay, here we go. The previous essay, I'm thinking I can copy this, just like cut and paste it and send it around, because it's really, really nice. The previous article is relinquishing the taste or desire for pratishtha. Pratishtha is aggrandizement, glorification, honor, praise. So then this is an essay. Published in The Harmonist, translated from Bengali, published in The Harmonist, or Rays of the Harmonist, in 2010. So that's maybe when this publication was made. Okay, so Matsarya. Matsarya means envy. Bhaktivinoda Thakur writes, the word Matsarya is used with different meanings in different contexts. Among its various meanings we find, here's one, enviousness of others' good fortune, or distress because of their success, or malice, or jealousy. When the word Matsarya has been used in the Vaishnava scriptures, it refers to that mood which is averse to prema, or pure love. And he quotes Bhagavatam 1.1.2, that dharma projita kaitavotra paramo nirmatsaranam satam, emphasis on that nirmatsaranam satam. And he quotes the whole verse, which I'm not going to read. So Matsarya is there, nirmatsaranam. So his translation of that verse, 1.1.2, is, in this Bhagavad Purana, where fraudulent religiosity and other mundane goals of humankind have been utterly forsaken, projita, kicked out, the supreme spiritual duty, Parama Dharma, has been expounded. That Parama Dharma is pure Bhakti Yoga, exemplified by those saints who are absolutely free from envy, Nirmatsaranam Satam, and full of compassion for all living beings. The supreme truth within uproots the three forms of misery and grants the highest form of bliss. When those with ample spiritual merit desire to listen to the message of this beautiful Bhagavatam, which was authorized by Mahamuni Sri Narayana himself, then the Supreme Lord Sri Hari is immediately and permanently captured within their hearts. What is the need of any other message? That his translation of 112. This statement defines who is fit to practice Parama Dharma, or that supreme spiritual duty propounded by Srimad Bhagavatam, and to relish the liquid humors of pure love, prema rasa, is truly the supreme spiritual duty that this gospel enjoins. Gospel, Christian terminology. He's speaking to an audience that's influenced by European ideology and Christian ideology, so he's... Those who are without envy, nirmatsara, are the only ones fit to practice this paramadharma. Nirmatsarata means, quote, the quality of being free from matsarya, or envy. Within the context of this verse, commentators have explained matsarata as feeling happiness upon seeing the misery of others, and misery upon seeing their happiness. But if the meaning of the word matsara is not illuminated in detail, it will not be understood by common people. So he goes into detail about what is envy. The jivas, confined by ignorance, have been entrapped in mundanity, mundane consciousness, by the rope of the six foes, or shad varga, six foes. So, lust, anger, greed, delusion, pride, and envy. Envy is number six. Matsarya. You know what they are. Kam, krodh, lobh, moha, mada, matsarya. Those are the six. These six are called shadvarga, and they are nothing but other forms of the five types of misery. So elsewhere he has described this, I'm familiar. Misery, avidya, is ignorance. Egotism, asmita. Infatuation, abhinivesh. Vehemence, raga, and hatred, dvesha. Raga, dvesha, abhinivesh, asmita, and avidya. These are, he's identifying, these are types of misery. And so, you know, in Bhagavad Gita's language, these are gates to hell. These shadvargas. And then the hell is these miseries. So one leads to the other. That's the first page. Here's two more pages. Extreme absorption in gross material objects gives rise to lust. In Bhagavad Gita, lust is described as follows. And he quotes verses 62 and 63 from chapter 2. Listen to how he explains Bhagavad Gita. It's really cool. It's like it's profound. Yeah, jayato vishayan punksa sangas teshu pajayate. Bhagavad Gita. Sangat sanjayate kama kama krodha bijayate. Very often quoted verses. The meaning is this, these verses is as follows. By meditating on sense objects, one inwardly mingles with them as such. Association with the sense objects in the form of acute absorption in them gives rise to lust, kama, which inevitably leads to anger, krodha. Anger gives rise to sammoha. So kam, krodha, moha. Anger gives rise to sammoha, that is greed or lobha, to enjoy the sense objects, even by unfair means. Greed for sense objects leads to loss of memory, moha, which in turn destroys the intelligence, or in other words, it leads to pride, mada. When people are prideful, their intelligence goes haywire. They can see, they think they're very smart, but driven by pride, their intelligence is misdirected, moha. wherein one fails to distinguish between virtue and evil. That pride leads to utter ruination, matsarya, which severely distorts the living entity's natural loving tendency. So he's saying already, now two things. Pride is the opposite. It totally blocks Krishna Prema or Parama Dharma or the goal of life. Pride is a big obstacle, more than an obstacle. So there's the enemy is these six, and then Bhagavad Gita instructs us, chapter 3, text 43. Interesting. Evam buddhe param buddhva samstha byadhyatma atmana. This is Bhagavad Gita 3.43. The meaning is as follows. Realize that the soul who belongs to the spiritual domain transcends the intelligence, controlling the mind through the principle of resolute determination, conquer that inextinguishable enemy known as kama. So how is kama, or how is lust, overcome? This is how. Controlling the mind through the principle of resolute determination, conquer that inexhaustible enemy known as kama. From all these instructions, it is clearly understood that by misunderstanding the nature of our true self, in other words, due to Svarup, B-H-R-A-M-A, Brahma, what does Brahma mean? B-H-R-A-M, it's one of the four defects of conditioned souls. Make mistakes. Bewilderment. The seed of lust sprouts in our hearts and gradually grows into the tree of envy, thus sending prema, which is jiva dharma, or the true nature of all living entities, far away. Lust, or kama, anger, krodha, greed, lobha, delusion, moha, and pride, mada, are all included in envy. He's like a lawyer building a case. He's going to explain that sentence in what follows. Lust is included in anger. Lust and anger are both included in greed. Lust, anger, and greed are within delusion. Lust, anger, greed, and delusion are found within pride, which refers to all kinds of pride, including pride in one's wealth, in one's beauty, in one's bodily prowess, in one's high caste, and in one's erudition. But envy, matsarya, encompasses all this. Lust, anger, greed, delusion, and all kinds of pride. All the miseries, that those are the gateways to misery, all the miseries of the living beings are truly embodied in envy. Two types of ignorance, namely unrighteous ignorance and righteous ignorance. What's righteous ignorance? Wicked acts, and that's papa and papa vasana. Papa vasana is the desire for sin and the sin itself, and commendable acts, and the desire to act commendably. Punya and punya vasana are all included within envy. He's going to explain. Why is piety and the desire to engage in piety included in envy? He's going to explain. The principle of Vaishnavism, or Vaishnava Dharma, namely compassion for all living entities, jive daya, compassion, daya, jive daya. It's jiva, but it's an evocative, it's jive. Compassion to all living entities. the loving inclination to chant the holy name, Name Ruchi, and service to the Vaishnavas, Vaishnava Seva, stand directly opposed to the condition of envy. Now, I've researched, and there's no formal source of the following, but it's a common Vaishnava understanding since like long, long time. These three, I'm going to go to my computer for just a second because it's a very nice translation. What are the three? Jive Daya, Name Ruchi, and Vaishnava Seva. Ihachara dharma nahi shuna sanatana. And the translation. When here's sanatana, exclamation point. Kindness to all living entities, taste for the holy name and service to the Vaishnavas. Apart from these, there is no other religion. Ihachara dharma nahi shuna sanatana. I'll read it again. Here, sanatana, these three, kindness to all living entities, taste for the holy name, and service to Vaishnavas. Apart from these, there is no other religion. And then short commentary, one sentence, two. When one has a taste for the holy name, one develops more compassion for the jivas. When one becomes free from offenses to the Vaishnavas, offenses rooted in envy, hatred, and false competition, the spirit of rendering genuine service to the Vaishnavas awakens. So there's service to the devotees, a taste for the name, and kindness to all living entities. And one helps the other. But so his point is, in this short essay, is those three are directly opposed to the condition of envy. Well, you could say envy is directly opposed to them, but they're by awakening those three, you focus on the positive, it helps diminish the negative. Those who feel distress upon seeing the happiness of others can never feel compassion for the living entities, and their hearts can never be suffused with the nectar of love of God. They maintain hatred and jealousy towards Vaishnavas, a hatred that arises from the long-standing distortion of their constitutional nature. And maybe you know some people that are envious, and they like to criticize devotees. Besides, it's very distasteful. It's very hurtful to those people. Last page. Only those who are free from envy have imbibed the true meaning of the verse beginning Trinadapi Suniche Na. You know, let's say the verse together. Trinadapi Suniche Na Dararapi Sahishnu Na Amani namana dena kirtaniya sadahari. So here's his translation. Only he who feels lower than a blade of grass and who is more tolerant than a tree, who expects no honor for himself but is able to give due respect to all others, is qualified to perpetually chant the holy names of Hari. That's this Namaruchi. So text three of six shastakas, I have no taste. So he's describing the taste, and what's blocking the taste is this big obstacle, envy, that has five other buddies. They're all gates to hell. A person who is free from envy possesses no false pride for wealth, beauty, high caste, education, or mundane physical strength, and therefore regards himself as even more insignificant, sunichena, than a blade of grass. He's describing humility, the Vaishnav humility. Such a person is also free from anger, aggressiveness, and violence. On account of that, he is even more tolerant, sunichena, than a tree. That is, he is exceedingly compassionate. Tolerance and compassion go together. Intolerance and lack of compassion go together. So where there's true compassion, it's not circumstantial. It's in all circumstances. So you tolerate. That's Prabhupada's example, commonly. The tree is the example of tolerance. So not only it tolerates the weather, but it just serves. You know, X, Y, Z, and so forth, types of service. Serves the birds and the squirrels and the people, and take my branches and take my fruits and take my leaves and take my this and take my that and cut me down, break a limb. No protest. Just serve. There's a very nice little story that's good for children and good for big children too, adults. The Giving Tree by Shel Silverstein. Are you familiar with that? Anyone here familiar with that? You are. So I'll send you the link. You send it to them. And it's just on, it's a children's story that has lots of meaning. Right? The Giving Tree. And, you know, the tree keeps giving and keeps giving and keeps giving and keeps giving. It doesn't have anything to give. She's sorry. She doesn't have anything to give. So compassion has no boundaries. But compassion that's not rooted in a spiritual conception, the other party is never satisfied. No matter how much you give and give and give. So you have to have a spiritual conception in the process of being compassionate. A person such as this, sunichena, sahishnuna, more tolerant than a tree. A person such as this, who is free from envy and false pride in his caste, education, and so on, despite being blessed with all virtue, never craves recognition or adoration from others. Thus he is amani, one who does not expect honor from anyone. That person, being free from envy, always feels happiness in the happiness of others and pain in their sorrow. And so he treats all living beings with due honor. Manada. In general, by being compassionate towards all living beings, he shows respect to them all by offering great honor to noble souls like Brahmanas and Vaishnava, Vaishnava Praya, unperfected Vaishnavas, showing respect even to unperfected Vaishnavas. He pleases them. And while devoting himself to the lotus feet of perfected Vaishnavas, he serves them. And he ends with 10 symptoms of the non-envious. And then we're done. Symptoms. He who is free from envy, by his very nature, never criticizes sadhus. 2. He does not consider demigods to be independent lords, for his intelligence is absorbed only in Sri Krishna, yet he does not disregard them. 3. He has faith, shraddha, in Sri Guru and all other superior devotees as befits each of them. 4. He offers respect to the bhakti scriptures like Shruti. 5. Abandoning meaningless arguments, he apprehends how the holy name is the topmost meaningful attainment, Paramartha, a perception rooted in perfect conviction that the holy name, Nama, and its owner, Nami, are one and the same. That's half of the 10. Number 6, he never engages in wickedness while depending on the protection of the holy name. 7, he does not consider the auspiciousness of ordinary piety, such as social dharma, religious vows, or renunciation, to be comparable in any way to chanting the holy names. 8, he tries to inculcate faith in the faithless, but never grants them the holy name until that faith has awakened. You recognize what he's doing? 10 offenses. 9, he believes completely in the glories of the holy name as described in the scriptures. And 10, he is devoid of any sense of I and mine in relation to mundanity, or mundane consciousness. Oh, readers, non-enviousness alone is liberation for the living being, and envy is his only bondage. In Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita, it is therefore said, Chaitanya Charita Shuna Shraddha Bhakti Kadi Matsarya Chadiya Mukhe Bala Bala Hadi Hadi. Endowed with full faith and devotion, listen to the life work of Sri Chaitanya, cast aside envy, and let your mouth sing Hadi Hadi. So I decided to read this for a couple of reasons. His rendering of Bhagavad Gita texts is very interesting. I mean, we're used to Prabhupada's way of rendering. And he has a particular, unique, acharya-like way of rendering. And it's very practical. It goes into lists and details and how this connects with that, connects with that. It's maybe like, you know, to understand his system of things, it's a little involved, but it is very logical and very practical. Another reason I wanted to read it is, something that the devotees, a common question that devotees ask during classes is the how-to question. You know, how to become sincere or how to overcome my weaknesses or something like that, how to. So that's an Arjunavritti. And the essays that are included in this publication, I'm going to cut and paste and send it to you. You sent to them. Very practical ways of, overcoming the shortcomings that are within us in the Arjunavritti under a magnifying glass. It's really very helpful, very practical. So now, to conclude, what I want to do is read, something over here. This is Bhaktivinoda Thakur's explanation of Bhagavad Gita, Chapter 9, Texts 30 and 31. They're famous verses. Apichet sudaracharo bhajate mam ananyabhak sadur eva samantavya, that verse. So this is a story that's told commonly by Bhaktisiddhanta about his father, and he heard the story from Krishnadas Babaji. Krishnadas Babaji was a contemporary of Bhaktisiddhanta, and Krishnadas Babaji had a very affectionate relationship with Prabhupada, or they had an affectionate relationship with one another. And So Krishnadas Babaji told this story to Bhaktisiddhanta, who then repeated it many times. And the story goes like this. Once, while absorbed in a dreamlike state, Bhaktivinoda Thakur entered the court of Yamaraj. And in the court of Yamaraj, there was an assembly of great persons who were discussing these two verses. Bhagavad Gita 9:30 and 9:31. Are you familiar with those verses? Anyone here? You're familiar with the verse. The topic is, how does Krishna regard somebody who engages in bad activity by circumstance, but they're unalloyed devotees? Vajate mam ananya bhak. Ananya bhakti. They're undivided devotees, and sometimes they do something that's bad. They're to be regarded as sadhu. And then the next verse says Krishna corrects that situation. He personally gets involved in that devotee's life and corrects the situation. 9:30, 9:31. They're important verses. So, the way it's translated here, even if one is most abominably behaved, if he is undeviatingly engaged in devotional service, he is to be considered a sadhu because he is properly situated in his determination. He quickly becomes righteous and attains lasting peace. O son of Kunti, declare that my devotee never vanquishes. Name bhakta pranashati. My devotee is never vanquished. So that those two verses were being discussed amongst, without the detail, Yamaraj, Brahma, Shiva, Narada, and the discussion question was, here's a doubt. It sounds like, it seems as if there's an assertion that says, by performing exclusive bhajan, ananya bhak, a person will attain dharma. And peace, which suggests that those states, dharma and peace, are lacking in bhakti, unless you go to the perfected stage, and that unalloyed bhakti, the ultimate pinnacle of dharma, is but a mere means for achieving such ends. Sounds like one might read it like that. So they were discussing. You understand the question? It's important. Should I say it again? I'll say it again. Notice in the translation there's several pronouns, he. So the specific question now here is, he quickly becomes righteous. Kipram bhavati dharmatma shashvachantim digashtati. He quickly attained dharma, dharmatma, and peace. Shantim. So the question is, wait a minute. How does that person achieve dharma and peace as if bhakti, until it's in the perfected stage, there's no dharma and there's no peace? And that the unalloyed devotion is just a means to get to dharma and peace. It sounds like, or it seems like, that's what's being said. So they were discussing. Seeing Bhaktivinoda Thakur arrive there, all the demigods rose from their seats as a gesture of respect and then presented their query to him. Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur settled the issue by explaining that in this context, saha, he, in the second verse, refers not to the sadhu, but to the one who, not being bewildered by the apparently abominable acts of a surrendered devotee, still considers that devotee to be a sadhu. He, who so considers, quickly becomes righteous. The observer of the bad activity, but considering the performer of that bad activity to be properly situated because of undivided devotion, that person who observes that way, the non-envious person, in this case, the saha pronoun, he, refers not to the sadhu, but to one who, not being bewildered by the apparently abominable acts of a surrendered devotee, still considers that devotee to be a sadhu. He who so considers quickly becomes righteous and attains lasting peace. Moreover, by not attempting to impose standards of worldly morality on a sadhu, he himself soon becomes a sadhu. Upon hearing this conclusion, the demigods offered obeisances to Bhaktivinoda Thakur. So, again, the context is Krishnadas Babaji describing something that happened to Bhaktivinoda Thakur and in a drifting into a dreamlike state, these things happened, and he apparently shared them with Krishnadas Babaji, who shared it with Bhaktisiddhanta, who shared it with the world. That Bhaktivinoda Thakur was very profound in his understanding meanings of things. I mean, I never would have thought that meaning. I never had thought of that meaning before reading this, so I wanted to share it. The sadhu is a sadhu. He doesn't attain peace and dharma. But it's the person who has proper regard for the sadhu, despite some discrepancy, because the foundation of that sadhu is ananya bhakti, that person attains dharma and lasting peace. And not only that, but they become themselves, the potential is that they become a sadhu. Interesting. And if many of Bhaktivinoda Thakur's writings are very deep, and not, you know, it takes, for me at least, it takes a few times of going over them to understand, you know, it's a different perspective. But it's a perspective that leads one, in our current stage of conditioning, it leads one to the higher platforms of bhakti. And just again to repeat for those of you that are householders, he was very clear about when he explained these things, when it was appropriate to do so, how it applies to a householder. Here, a practical example, I gave a whole seminar in Naperville on a book by Bhaktivinoda Thakur called Bhaktiloka. And I'm sure the recordings are available somewhere. All it is, Bhakti Loka, is describing two verses from Nectar of Instruction. You all know what Nectar of Instruction is because Prabhupada translated it as part of the Bhakti Shastri course. When you get to the stage of taking Bhakti Shastri, you'll study Nectar of Instruction, one of the four books. And two of the verses are six things that destroy bhakti, six things that are favorable to bhakti. And Bhakti Loka is just describing those six. And the six. With detail. And when he explains them, how do you apply this principle to be done and the not to be done things? This is how it applies for the sadhu. This is how it applies for the grahastha. I'll give an example and then I'll end. The example is not associating with worldly people. then he explains, you know, sadhus, how it looks for a sadhu is like this and how it looks for a grihastha is like that. So when you go to the workplace, they're not, Vaishnavas. So it's not, you're not supposed to go to the workplace. So how do you follow that instruction? And he explains, you engage in proper conduct, civil conduct. Hello, how are you? How is everything? And all those kinds of conversational things. It's just that when it comes down to some personal directional life matters, you don't consult with them on those things. You consult with Vaishnavas and elevated Vaishnavas on those things. You conduct yourself in the world in a gentlemanly or ladylike manner, you know, a proper courtesy giving conduct manner. And he certainly knew how to do that. Being a magistrate, a high court judge, he had some social obligations. He had to meet with all kinds of people. And he did it very, very gracefully, and he didn't push anything, but he was very expert at taking the conversation to spiritual topics in a way that, you know, they were comfortable with and so on. He was really, really good at it. He was an excellent householder. Very, very powerful personality. And it comes out in his teachings, you know, how to practically execute duties in life, in the world, householder or renunciate. Okay, so that's part one of a three-part series on Bhaktivinoda Thakur's life. So I'd like to cover different things for the different audiences. See if there's some discussion. Bhaktivinoda Thakur ki jai. Yes. No. Anyone, anything? Oh, you have. Okay.
Hare Krishna Guru Maharaj.
Go right ahead.
I was listening online, actually, in the class. In the beginning of the class, you asked, like, what comes to your mind when you think about Bhaktivinoda Thakur, right? That I want to say a few things, Maharaj, on that. Like, the brave is brave. And he's confident. And the third thing which I could think of is the unflinching faith actually he had on Supreme Personality of Godhead. I was watching the Abhay Charan, the YouTube, the movie which was there.
I'm familiar with what it is, yes.
It was so nice actually, like how he's running his life. In parallel, they were showing about Prabhupada, childhood days as well. Like, the scenes were kept in such a way that this is Bhaktivinoda Thakur, how he's preaching and how he's doing everything and how Prabhupada is growing up also. In that, like, some of the scenes from that, I could understand actually how brave he is. Okay. When you are explaining, Maharaj, this question came to my mind, like, now we are getting association by God's fortunate. During his time, right, it was so difficult time. Like they destroyed all our Vedas, all our beliefs and everything. How he got that strength, like a single man army, right? He was preaching and he was so strong and he was giving the energy to everyone. So how it was possible for him?
According to Chaitanya Charitamrita, it requires empowerment by Krishna. Krishna Shakti Vina Nahi Tara Pravartana. Krishna empowered him. Then the next question is, why did Krishna empower him and not all the other Prabhus? Well, he was capable of receiving that empowerment. So he gave it to him.
So, Mr. Maharaj, yesterday I had a question in my mind, but today it's somehow I'm getting the answer. I'm clarifying with you. Like, we always talk about Krishna's pastimes, right? Krishna's pastime. It happened in the past, right? I was thinking...
No. Pastime okay. Doesn't mean it happened in the past.
Oh,
that's okay. Not what it means. Pastime means Just having fun.
Just having fun. Okay. So then my question was, this is what in my mind, Mike, Maharaj, like, is there anything happening right now?
Krishna is pleasing. Oh, yeah. His past times are eternal. Right now. You've misunderstood the meaning of the word pastime. So delete that one. And reinstall the correct one.
So is it okay to understand this way also, Maharaj? Like Bhakti Vinod Thakur, Srila Prabhupada, and then Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur. So these people appeared in this world and they did a lot of teaching and they've done a lot of things, right? That also, can I take it as a Krishna's pastime that way?
No. It's an instrument of Krishna's pastime.
Got it.
You can stretch it a little bit and say, well, that means it's Krishna's pastimes, right? Because what's the instrument, but who's wielding the instrument? But we make a distinction. Okay.
And one more question. It's my daughter's question. I don't know whether she could ask or I can speak for her.
Let's see if she wants to. She want your father to speak or you want to say it?
Hare Krishna Guru Maharaj. Do you have to chant in Goloka too?
Do we have to chant in Goloka? You don't have to. It's spontaneous. Do rivers have to flow in Goloka Vrindavan? They flow. There's rivers and they flow. And people are, they're not obliged to chant. They're chanting. They're non-stop chanting. Singing, dancing. No. Are they chanting japas? I guess maybe that's what you want to know. They're just doing spontaneous. Let's supposing in this world someone become perfected. Do they still chant? Yeah. So then in the spiritual world, do they still chant? Yeah. Not because they're obliged to. They're told it's good for you. Eat your spinach. You follow?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay?
Thank you so much.
Anyone else? He's got something back here. Over here.
So, Hare Krishna, why is Srimad Bhagavatam named Srimad Bhagavatam?
Why is it named Srimad Bhagavatam?
Yeah.
Well, you know what Srimad means, right? Beautiful. Beautiful, marvelous. That's what Srimad means. And Bhagavatam means in relation to Bhagavan. Bhagavata means in relation to Bhagavan. That's Bhagavata. And because it's a book, it's called Bhagavatam. There's a certain grammatical rule is Bhagavatam. You can say Bhagavat Purana. Bhagavat means in relation to Bhagavan.
So it's beautiful in relation to Bhagavan.
That's right.
Hare Krishna Guru Maharaj. I have a question, like, when we do chanting and our mind will go here and there, so what should we say to our mind to bring back our mind and say that concentrate on chanting?
You're asking, is it a correct understanding? Or you're asking how to do it.
How to do it.
Well, there's different answers, but the one I like in particular is, two. The instruction to do so carries the capacity to do it. So in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, wherever the mind wanders due to its flickering and unsteady nature, bring the mind back. So the how-to is within the instruction to do so. It takes power to control the mind because the mind is not used to being controlled. It's used to being a monkey. Goes all over the place doing monkey business. No, you know, higher purpose. I mean, it's a material purpose, but not a higher. So it's the instruction to do so. And by practice and practice and practice and practice, the monkey can be controlled. The mind can be controlled. So that's one. Another is my favorite, and that is Bhakti Siddhanta says, by the ear you can control the mind. So there's six senses, and then there's the mind. So there's five senses, and there's the mind, makes six. And they're competing. I want, I want, I want. However, when the ear hears the sound, he explains, the ear can control the mind. Sound vibration heard with not just, you know, this thing, the fleshy thing in the side of our head, the organ, but the sense of hearing and the spiritual sense of hearing, then the mind becomes conquered. He says, the mind no longer quibbles because the mind becomes controlled by the ear. So the mind submits to the ear. And it's true. So the practice is, one can practice controlling the mind, or one can practice hearing, which controls the mind. No? Okay. Over in the corner? Over in the corner?
Hare Krishna Guru Maharaj. So my question is that, what's the difference between kirtan and doing japa? I mean, you're singing in one and you're chanting, but you're essentially just singing the Maha Mantra in kirtan. So is it possible that I could replace chanting with just singing the japa?
Well, you can supplement, but not replace. We do both, but we don't replace one with the other. We don't replace japa with kirtan. We don't replace kirtan with japa. We do both. There's a function for each of them, but let me ask you a question. Why would you ask that question? Let me suggest an answer. Well, I have no trouble being like really absorbed when it's kirtan. I do have trouble when I pick up my beads and try to chant japa. Something like that. And it's not uncommon. It's not like, you know, you're an oddball or something. It's quite common. So why is that? And, you know, one suggestion of why it is, you know, in the world, music is very popular. And some of the things that goes under the name of music really is like noise. But, you know, music is, It's a universal language, music. People like music. All cultures, all people, all, you know, birds like, they like music. So, there's an attraction to the musicality of kirtan. Natural. And there's a social aspect also. You're with another person, you're doing something with another person. And so that's, you know, that's enlivening too. And then, you know, perfecting the skill of the musical instrument. You put all those things together and now you got me. I'm absorbed. Now take those things away, and it's just three things. The chanter, the name, and the mind. And, you know, ask her. You know, the mind. That the challenge is the mind goes to the name. So when you're doing kirtan, is the mind going to the name or is the mind going to those other things that are a little easier for the mind than to transcendence? Because music in itself is not transcendental. The social interaction is not in itself transcendental. The perfecting the skill of a particular instrument is not in itself transcendental. But connect it with the name and it gets some spiritual juice. So, you know, do lots of kirtan because you like it. And do some chanting of japa because it'll help you bring your mind to the name when the kirtan is going on and not just the social, musical, and other things that are like yummy and easy. Then you'll have a much different, much superlative experience during kirtan than without having attraction for the name. Okay? Yeah, you're enthusiastic to say something, I can tell.
Hare Krishna, Guru Maharaj. I have few more points which I missed to tell in my previous conversation. Let me say it now. Like, when I first heard about Bhaktivinoda Thakur, what amazed me is how Britishers respected him. And I never heard in my whole life there was a train track built on to go to somebody's house, actually. Train track for the railway station, it would be there, not to somebody's house. So when I heard about they built a railway track just for his house, just to transport him.
Well, it wasn't just for his house, but it was for his house. Because the magistrate in charge of Krishna Nagar knew there's a bunch of people over there, and because Bhaktivinoda lived there, it started filling up with other people. So it was a practical thing for the other people. But it was for Bhaktivinoda, so he could come and do his job in the justice in the courtroom. It was for him. If it weren't for him, it wouldn't be there. Okay, next.
Yeah.
Let's not dwell on it. Let's move.
Yes, Maharaj. So on that point only, I want to add on is normally when I, from my childhood, if I see, right, if there is some mysteries happened in your life or something if you're losing, or then during that time only you will go surrender to God. In my vision, I don't know if any successful people also follow God, right? I didn't know in my childhood days. But when I see this person, right, he was so successful and he was also so much following his God consciousness. Mm. So that I liked at Maharaj. And the second point is the giving, right? It's not that this knowledge is shared with everybody. Otherwise the people like me can't access this knowledge at all. So thankful for him for spreading this knowledge and giving it to so many people.
Hare Krishna. We have online questions.
Question from Sanchari. When you stated that a spiritual conception is needed to show true compassion to others, I was thinking that the recipient also needs to have a spiritual conception in order to be grateful for the compassion that's being given to them. Then the tree can continue to grow as it keeps giving itself. How do we, as aspiring devotees, understand this in relationships where the other person does not have that spiritual conception?
Well, there's cleansing before they have the spiritual conception. Cleansing is needed before the spiritual conception can rise, because the spiritual conception is covered by the other kind material. So by compassion, by extending the cleansing method or process, the cleansing and then the spiritual conception and then the gratitude.
This question is from Gadai Gauranga Prabhu. He's quoting the shloka, Akama Sarva Kamova Moksha Kama Udharadi. So in connection to it, when I read some glimpses of Sri Bhaktivinoda Thakur's life, I am unable to understand why does he primarily worship or he pray to Bimala Devi at Jagannath Puri for conceiving a son who could take forward Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's mission instead of Lord Hari.
Well, I don't know where you get the idea that he primarily prayed to Bimala Devi. He named his son Bimala Prasad, but this Bimala that he gave the name to his son is the same name that's in the Jagannath temple that after the Prasad of Lord Jagannath is then taken from the altar, it's placed first at Bimala Devi's altar. And that's the Bimala Devi is the internal potency Bimala, not the demigoddess Bimala.
Question from Sundari. I don't know whether it is Sundari rather. Envy is so dangerous, but also so deeply rooted in my thinking. Do you have recommendations of parts of scripture and prayers that I should study and pray using so I can try and rid myself of envy?
I don't know of any specific get rid of envy prayers. The Shikshastaka verse is the one that makes the most sense to me. And if I haven't copied and pasted, but you send me a message to remind me to send you a copy of this article I just read, and then you can go through the article and I think you'll have some bullets to fire at your envy.
This is from Tripti Mataji. My question is in relation to the answer that you just gave. Narada Muni was aware of Brajadam and Brajaprem. Then why does Prahlad not attain Brajaprem? Is it because he was not qualified to receive it?
We covered that question the other day.
Yeah, why did she type it again? Oh, second part. What should be one's qualification to receive this tremendous...
We covered that also.
Okay. Maybe I think she was not present in the yesterday.
You can listen to yesterday.
Okay. This is from Radha, Paramarupa Prabhu's daughter.
Hey Radha. Hare Krishna.
A few classes before
She's
you
nine.
Said...
How old are you? 10. She's 9. Go ahead, Radha.
A few classes before you said that academics is meant to serve Krishna. I understand how English can be used in service of Krishna. I do not understand how math can be used in service to Krishna.
It's practical and as well as conceptual. A practical, just Radha, I just sent a very detailed set of questions that are all dealing with numbers to the person in charge of the TOVP plan and asking, you know, it's math questions, it's number questions, not exactly math questions, but it helps to have a clear picture of what the Bhagavatam is telling us, what's the structure of this universe. And it's quantifiable. There's numbers involved of, you know, so many things, not only distances and size of planets and so forth, but, you know, how you calculate what a day is and how you calculate what a month is and how you calculate what a year is. And there's different ways of calculating a year. There's the movements of the moon and there's the movements of the sun and the movements of the sun around Sumeru and movements of the sun in relation to the pole star. So if you don't have a grasp of math, you're not even going to think those questions. You'll just bounce. But if so, maybe you don't, you know, if somebody doesn't really want to understand the world that we live in, then you don't need math. But if you want to understand the world that you live in, it's a tool that will help you get a picture of the world we live in. And because there's the material one and there's the spiritual one, and how do you understand the distinction between the two? Because there are distinctions. Math is needed. You don't need a PhD in math, but you have to have some basic, you know, grasp. Go ahead.
This is Keshav Kishore Prabhu from Mayapur. Can we say that Bhakti Vinod Thakur and Srila Prabhupada are of the same caliber in terms of the importance of the spreading of Lord Chaitanya's teachings?
Well, that's an interesting question. And quite similar. I don't know if you could say equal. I guess it would depend upon what part of the spiritual family you're in, whether you would say it's, you know, who's greater. And we don't like to do stuff who's greater, equal importance or greater importance. In our lives, Srila Prabhupada is our founder, acharya, and principal shiksha guru, but his teachings and his efforts, I'm going to be speaking about it this evening. The whole TOVP was a vision given to the world by Bhaktivinoda Thakur, and Prabhupada filled it, or he gave it to us to fulfill. The whole TOVP project is Bhaktivinoda Thakur's brainchild, but then Prabhupada did it. Prabhupada, you know, brought it to the into reality. So I'm reluctant to say yes or no. Yes, equal. No, this one's greater, that one's greater. I'm reluctant.
The second part of the question, maybe you touched it, Guru Maharaj. If yes, why he is not appreciated as Srila Prabhupada? If not, why not?
Okay, next.
This is from Chennai. I am pursuing my post-graduation in pediatrics in India. I know that Your Holiness was once an aspiring medical student.
Uh-huh.
How can I help get to my own self and others in Krishna consciousness?
How can I do stick to Krishna consciousness and give it to others? That's the question?
Yeah, I don't know. How can I help get to my own self? How can I become Krishna conscious, I think, and bring others into Krishna?
Well, you follow the bhakti process, this how-to question. Follow the bhakti process, you'll become compassionate and get some strength and you can give to others. I mean, that the how-to questions are too broad. Next. Okay. Thank you very much. Prabhupada ki jai.
So next, Srila Rupa Swami Maharaj.